The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Camille Bernadine DeGrotto was born in San Diego, California, on February 17, 1947. She was the only child born to Joseph and Evelyn DeGrotto, both from Chicago, Illinois. Camille's father, Joseph, was a World War II United States Army veteran. He and Camille's mother, Evelyn Palermo, were married in 1943, and after his service, Joseph DeGrotto began following a path he'd claim was given to him by God as he laid ill on his deathbed, the path of evangelism. Joseph DeGrotto's chosen life trajectory likely had a profound effect on his daughter Camille's. By the early 1950s, Joseph was traveling to churches across the United States, preaching his story of, quote, miracles, salvation, and healing to large crowds, both in person and across the radio waves. His sermons gained popularity fast, and soon he was co-hosting events alongside the evangelist Reverend Oral Roberts, who was as close a peer to Joseph as anyone. Both men, after all, said they were given a sign by God roughly around the same time, told to travel and spread the word, and even heal the diseased and crippled through the touch of God. Oral Roberts went on to greater fame and notoriety, but DeGrotto's career as a traveling evangelist wasn't to scoff at. When Joseph became known officially as Reverend DeGrotto in the mid-50s, his presence drew large crowds. The tent revivals in which he often participated in often relied on his name on ads to get folks to come, alongside promises of healing the sick and glimpses of the evil devastation of communism through his film titled Behind the Iron Curtain. The quote, dynamic, fiery, world-traveling evangelist was called to bring healing to sick, suffering humanity, the ad said, encouraging those who might attend to bring the deaf, blind, and the lame for God to heal. By the late 1950s, ads promoting Joseph DeGrotto's events also promised the anointed angelic singing of his wife Evelyn and daughter Camille. Joseph DeGrotto continued to travel through the 1960s, his revivals all over the United States and South American countries only increasing with popularity, with Evelyn and Camille accompanying him when they were able. In 1960, the DeGrotto family had already established roots in the Dallas, Texas suburb of Oak Cliff. Camille was described as an outgoing and personable child and teenager who had a love of animals in particular, often rescuing and caring for neighborhood strays. A friend later said that as an adult, Camille would, quote, take you in just like a cat if she thought you were a stray person. She was sweet and caring, friends and family said. Camille DeGrotto graduated from South Oak Cliff High School in 1964 on the B Honor Roll and was involved in many activities throughout her high school years, including the Folklore Club, Science Club, and the Red Cross, along with activities more suited to what might have been considered Camille's greatest talent, namely the school's concert choir, the Golden Tones. Her love of singing followed her throughout her life. Camille often sang at nightclubs as a young adult, once even catching the eye of future country music star Larry Gatlin of the Gatlin Brothers. He and Camille shared a brief romantic stint not long before his career blew up. There's little doubt that Camille's passion and sheer talent made her stand out, as did her dark hair, dark eyes, and toned Italian complexion. She continued to perform and write music. Camille married a man named William Wagoner in 1969. Though the wedding at the Faith Temple Assembly of God Church in Richardson was large and elaborate, the two divorced in 1972. It wasn't the last time Camille's love life turned bad, but the marriage did give her a daughter, Nikki, who she gave up music for, even as she was offered a recording contract. A life of cutting records and touring to promote them, Camille decided, would take away time from her daughter. Camille returned to her roots, giving up nightclub singing for Christian contemporary, singing at churches and conferences to feed her passion without giving up spending time with her daughter. Camille tied the knot a couple more times, neither marriage lasting 10 years. By 1996, 48-year-old Camille Norman, last name still that of her third husband, was known as Meemaw. Her daughter, Nikki, was now a mother of two. By this time, Camille had settled into a part-time sales job at the Room Store, which sold furniture and home accessories. She was living in Pleasant Grove, a suburb of Dallas, just southeast of the city. The quaint community was first settled in the 1840s, and a schoolhouse called Pleasant Grove, due to the cottonwood trees that surrounded it, came many years later, along with a church. By the early 20th century, Pleasant Grove had grown into a small but viable Dallas County community, and though the small town fought incorporation for as long as it could, Dallas City ultimately annexed Pleasant Grove in 1954, and it became essentially a suburb, though not one without its own identity. On the morning of Wednesday, January 31st, 1996, Camille called her friend, newlywed Carol, to let her know she was having car trouble. The visit she was planning to Carol's house would have to wait. Though Carol offered to come get her, Camille declined, saying she'd better go ahead and get the car fixed before the problem interfered with work and other plans. It's likely Camille didn't want Carol driving because she was undergoing cancer treatment at the time. Camille had recently broken up with her boyfriend, another bad luck bout with romance, so having her car up and running was a good idea. At around 11:15 a.m., Camille called Nikki, her daughter, asking if she'd follow her to the mechanic. She didn't want to go alone and chance being stranded if her car broke down along the way. Nikki was distracted and barely made out what her mother was asking, because besides her infant son and toddler daughter, she was babysitting a couple other children for a friend. Nikki told her mother she'd call her right back after getting the kids wrangled, which took her 45 minutes. Nikki called Camille back at around noon, but there was no answer. She assumed her mother had gotten a hold of someone else to follow her to the mechanic. At about 2 p.m., Camille's friend, Carol, called her to make sure she'd been able to get the car to the shop. Camille didn't answer. At approximately 7:30 p.m., the man who Camille had been renting a room to returned to her house from work. She'd been renting out a room in the modest, red brick Pleasant Grove home since she had the spare space and since extra income is always a good thing. Nothing was amiss as the man approached the front door. There were no signs of forced entry or a struggle. As he opened the door, however, it was readily obvious that something was horribly wrong. A trail of blood began just inside the door, leading through the house to Camille's bedroom, where she laid lifeless and bloodied. After entering the home of Camille Norman, where he rented a room, a man was aghast to find a trail of blood beginning just inside the front door, leading to Camille's bedroom, as if she'd been attacked after answering the door and then dragged the length of the house to where she was found. The man immediately phoned the police. According to the autopsy, Camille Norman suffered 29 stab and slash wounds to her chest, back, and neck. She'd been strangled and shot in the head. There were no signs of sexual assault, leading police to believe that rape was not the motive. Though investigators didn't know if her attacker had taken it, Camille's diamond necklace was missing. Since her many other valuables in the home weren't taken, however, including expensive musical equipment, it appeared as though robbery wasn't a motive either. When Dallas homicide detectives spoke with Camille's daughter, Nikki, she insisted that her mother would have never opened the door to a stranger. She always asked who was knocking, Nikki told investigators, and if she didn't know them, she didn't answer. Nikki, beyond being ravaged with shock and grief, was scared. She knew everyone her mother knew, so in her mind, she knew her mother's killer. Nikki was convinced that detectives were acting at first as though they thought the slaying of Camille was random. She felt that notion was wrong, and following that theory could potentially hinder the case. On Tuesday, January 30th, 1996, the day before Camille Norman was murdered, a Balk Springs woman, 76-year-old Eva Hopkins, was slain in her home. Balk Springs is a city in Dallas County, directly east of Pleasant Grove, and where Eva Hopkins was stabbed to death and robbed in her home was only about 4 miles from where Camille was slain. Dallas homicide investigators, alongside Balk Springs detectives, were sharing information on their cases with the theory that they could be connected. It wasn't long before Balk Springs detectives identified a suspect after the mother of a 19-year-old man told police that he'd phoned her and claimed to have killed a woman. The suspect and his girlfriend were threatening to kill themselves, the man's mother said. They were heroin addicts who stole to obtain the drug, his mother told police, and they had a suicide pact. They'd stolen her mother's car and disappeared. On Thursday, February 1st, at approximately 2:10 p.m. in Pleasant Grove, a Dallas police officer in an unmarked vehicle ran the plates of the stolen Geo Prism and gave chase. The chase lasted 25 miles, with marked police cruisers joining the unmarked vehicle in pursuit, and the suspect and his girlfriend had slit their wrists in the process of the chase. When the chase ended, they were taken into custody and subsequently hospitalized for their injuries. Both individuals were on parole for a robbery in Mesquite the previous year, where the two had approached an elderly woman, attempted to take her purse, and dragged the woman across an asphalt parking lot as she held on to it. The suspect's girlfriend told her mother that he and some friends had been burglarizing homes in the area for drug money. Since the slayings of Eva Hopkins and Camille Norman were only days old, these facts interested police, and they began scrutinizing the 19-year-old man in those crimes. Dallas police, in fact, seemed almost certain they'd found their suspect or suspects in quotes they made to the press. That changed, however, after the arrest of a 15-year-old boy for the slaying of a barber and beautician at her Balk Springs shop. On Thursday, March 14, 1996, a customer entered A&S Style Shop in Balk Springs at about 2 p.m. The client was horrified to see the shop's owner, Sita Haddadi, lying face down on the floor in a pool of blood. She was lifeless, shot once in the back of her head. Missing from the shop's till, what Sita was killed for, was $16. Sita Haddadi was married with a 16-year-old daughter and had been considering selling A&S Style Shop, where her employees and customers all loved her. It took no time for Balk Springs investigators to develop a suspect. He'd practically given himself up on a silver platter. The day before the murder and robbery, on Wednesday the 13th, three teens were in the shop, and one of them was continually asking Sita questions like how much the business made and if any men worked there. The teenager had "crazy" tattooed on his forearm, so it wasn't difficult for detectives to identify him as Travis Dwayne Crabtree, also of Balk Springs. He was quickly brought in for questioning, and things were moving fast. At Crabtree's home, police found a 9mm handgun, which ballistics testing would later match to the bullet removed from Sita Haddadi's head. Crabtree's mother, too, had something interesting for detectives. She handed them a piece of paper containing a detailed list. step-by-step instructions to perform the robbery at A&S Style Shop. Check for cameras and cut the phone line were among the items listed, along with the sixth and final instruction that read simply, kill. Also found in Crabtree's home was a knife that an accomplice of the 15-year-old would identify as the weapon used to kill 76-year-old Eva Hopkins on January 30th. It was identified after the accomplice's girlfriend came to police, telling them that her boyfriend had told her that Crabtree killed Eva when they robbed her. The original charges against the 19-year-old man, of course, were dropped, and 15-year-old Travis Dwayne Crabtree, also known by the nicknames Crazy and Double X, was tried as an adult for the murder of Sita Haddadi and sentenced to life in prison. It's unclear why he wasn't tried for the murder of Eva Hopkins. Crabtree remains in prison to this day and was never linked to the slaying of Camille Norman in Pleasant Grove. The investigation into who killed Camille Norman was sluggish and going nowhere. After Dallas homicide investigators were unable to come up with any answers, they told Camille's daughter, Nikki, that they believed it was someone close to her mother, someone with a personal reason to harm Camille, which is what Nikki believed all along. A year went by with no leads or suspects at all, so Nikki took matters into her own hands. On the first anniversary of Camille's murder, in January of 1997, Nikki gave out flyers in her mother's Pleasant Grove neighborhood. The flyers, of course, gave information about Camille's slaying, along with a photo, and asked for any information that might help solve the crime to be reported to the Dallas police. She was attempting to generate leads for the department, something they struggled to do on their own. Nikki was scared to be in the neighborhood, passing out the flyers and asking questions, but felt that if she didn't, the killer would sink farther and farther away from justice. She didn't want her mother's murder, she said, to be lost among all the other cold cases that go forever unsolved. Still, Nikki couldn't help but wonder, quote, if they hurt my mom that bad, what would they do to keep us from finding out who they are? Unfortunately, nothing came of Nikki's efforts. It had only been a year and the Dallas police had no more leads at all. Homicide detectives commented that while the case remained open, it was not being investigated actively. Only a lead or tip reported to them would garner any activity on Camille Norman's case. Even in the media, since the beginning, Camille Norman's murder saw little attention. In 1996, the Dallas Police Department's homicide unit cleared around 70% of their cases, a percentage well above the national average considering the city's size. Investigators working Camille's murder case welcomed an ongoing dialogue with her daughter, Nikki. Nikki was satisfied with the detectives' claims that they were doing all they could, but her mother's case had gone completely cold. Over the years, the Dallas Cold Case Squad has come and gone. The program ran from 1996 to the year 2000. In 2002, an exclusive cold case unit did not exist, but two special investigations detectives were charged with working cold cases when they could fit them in, atop the regular workload of officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths. In 2008, the Dallas Cold Case Squad was again revived and only lasted a couple years. In a 2013 Dallas Morning News article, when a cold case unit didn't exist at the department, a supervisor in the Crimes Against Persons Division said that Camille Norman's case had been reviewed with fresh eyes every time a squad was reassigned to cold cases. The Dallas Police Department's Cold Case Squad was re-established in 2016, but again dissolved in May of last year, 2019. It's unclear whether or not Camille's case was reviewed again during the squad's latest incarnation. If Camille's daughter, Nikki, would have headed right over to her mother's the morning she was murdered, she too might have become a victim, along with her children and the children she was watching that day. The guilt of not doing so, however, has stuck with Nikki through the years. She wore the ring her mother died wearing as a reminder to stay vigilant. During those years, Nikki wrote to every national television crime program and talk show host, hoping to get a larger audience and more exposure for Camille's unsolved murder, but to no avail. She said as soon as interest came, it also fizzled out. Joseph and Evelyn DeGrotto, Camille's parents, kept in contact with the Dallas Police Department too, calling them 3 or 4 times a year in hopes of news or to prod them into movement. For a long time after Camille's death, Nikki traveled to Galveston Beach to release balloons in tribute to her mother. Her children, Camille's grandchildren, attached little notes to the balloons, which were purple, Camille's favorite color. The messages on the notes read, "I love you and I miss you." At some point, however, Nikki stopped. It was time for her to live for her children, she said, and not her mother's unsolved murder case. In 2007, Nikki moved to Florida to be nearer to her grandparents and to help them as they aged. Since Camille was Evelyn and Joseph's only child, Nikki and her kids were the only family the couple had left. Though the DeGrottos found strength in their faith, they never recovered from the pain of losing Camille. Camille's granddaughter's few memories of her include singing with her in church. She grew up listening to tapes of her grandmother singing and often found great comfort in it. Camille Norman was cremated, her ashes scattered into the ocean off a Cancun, Mexico beach. If you have any information about the murder of Camille Norman, please help provide answers by calling North Texas Crime Stoppers at 877-373-8477. Please stick around to hear a trailer for the podcast Apple for the Teacher, a truly unique take on the true crime genre. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50 a month, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. Patreon exclusives include The Thrill Killers and The Odessa Lust Murderer, among others. If you're a donor there, be on the lookout for our upcoming exclusive episode about a depraved Dallas doctor whose total number of victims is likely unknown. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. We appreciate y'all's support beyond words. The Encyclopedia of Country Music, the Dallas Morning News, the Plano Star Courier, the Waxahachie Daily Light, the Grand Prairie Daily News, and the Ohio Evening Review were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hello, everyone. Let me tell you about the Apple for the Teacher podcast. I'm Anna Thomas, a teacher and your host. So you're probably thinking it's about reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? Well, think again. It's a fresh take on true crime, where you wouldn't expect to find true crime. In schools, yes, schools. I will share with you the tragic and shocking stories I have uncovered in my own profession. You will hear stories about murder, abduction, school bus hijack, student disappearance, suicide, kidnap and ransom, school camp tragedy, the list goes on. So if you're looking for something a little different in the true crime genre, then Apple for the Teacher is for you. So join me as I present The Bad Apples. But until then, remember to be a good apple.